welcome to another episode of the Albion Raw here on Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM, online, radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course, on our podcast. I'm AD Packham, and we are not adjusting our sets in association with oldfootballshirts.com. Well, it was another frustrating afternoon in Croydon on Sunday, where despite completely dominating, again, a penalty that wasn't a penalty and poor finishing, again, saw us have to be rescued by a late Alexis McAllister goal to escape with a point. So concerns about our finishing linger then. Good job we've added some more firepower with the addition of Danny Welbeck to the squad, which is a signing which caught most of us by surprise. The TV gods have moved this weekend's game against West Brom to Monday night, which is bad enough, but the fact it kicks off at 5:30 and is our first pay-per-view game has got many up in arms. Joining me today, of course, is Alan Wares, and we're delighted to be joined by the fabulous Andy Bass, and also joining us later on is Neil Atkinson from the Anfield Wrap. Now, Andy, we had a interesting afternoon on Sunday where we were able to watch the game together, but in obviously socially distanced. And Al, you were at the ground, so we've all got various different viewpoints on this. So let's start with you, Alan. I understand there were some interesting antics going on at Croydon Station when you arrived there.
Absolutely nothing was happening. I mean, therein lies the point. It's East Croydon Station. When it's 90 minutes before kickoff. Picture the scene. Anyone who's been to an away game at Selhurst, it's 90 minutes before kickoff. The platforms are heaving with spectators who are sort of doing their little dance, waiting for something to kick off, and then they run away and then they bounce on their shoes again. And you've got rows and rows of police. Nothing. It was post-apocalyptic. It was horrible. Don't get me wrong. It's nice to actually just make your way to the ground without being unencumbered. But dear God, it's going to the Amex is one thing, but going to Selhurst on a Sunday when it's grey, and believe it or not, there's a Premier League game going on and nothing is there. It's a very, very bizarre feeling. That said, we were greeted by the sight of six charming little Palace ultras with their funny banner waiting up outside. Empty stands, same war, South London expects. No idea what that means. Andy, you're a London chap. Any idea what that means?
Absolutely no idea what that means. But, you know, well done. Shakespeare it isn't.
It's
frustrating. I mean, all of these games. I mean, I've said on the show before that, I mean, going to the Amex on a game when we're playing big teams and there's no atmosphere in the town, no buzz about it. It'd be the same up there because, I mean, going to a Palace game, it's kind of, I'm not going to call it a rite of passage, but it's for Brighton fans, it's something you have to do at least once, I think. And yeah, for it to be so devoid of anything. And it's the same for them, right? So it's absolutely horrible.
Well, I thought it was more like a Renf game, to be honest. You know, for Brighton against Palace, it felt more like that. I mean, it was the same intensity, but whether I'd have gone to Selhurst Park, whether I'd have gone to anywhere in London, I think gone to any game where you'd have had the same level of silence, the same, so few people apart from those in the press box, it's very, very unpleasant. And as you said at the top of the show, AD, we can't get fans back in the stadium quick enough. Let's hope we can find a way of being able to do so.
I mean, just to go off topic for a second here, I mean, I was watching some of the Champions League games this week, and you're getting the same sort of atmosphere in all of the grounds around the continent. But in Rennes, they were allowed to have fans. They were allowed 5,000 fans, and apparently it's all down to local jurisdiction. But there was 5,000. There's no social distancing going on at all, I have to point out as well. Yeah. I mean, it was cracking to watch a game with fans and an atmosphere in amongst all the other stuff going on. But I'm not quite sure are they getting a sporting advantage by having fans there? That's another story for another day. But I mean, it was interesting to see that in certain parts of France, they are allowing people in. And it was just nice to hear a noise that wasn't generated by a TV director.
Well, we're back at the original argument that we've had certainly Brighton fans have had for quite a while now, certainly for the past couple of months, is that we know how to put on a match where people are socially distanced. And even then, it was 2,500 for the Chelsea game, and even it was the use of one stand. Yes, we do know there are other issues at other grounds. That, you know, you can't necessarily say, well, Brighton can have 5% or 20% or 16% and Selhurst Park can have this and Anfield can have that and so on and so forth. It doesn't necessarily work that way. But it does show that we can have something. And yet I think that football still is being stigmatised. And I don't know why. I know that we've got there's a parliamentary debate coming up on November the 9th. But I'd like to think they're actually going to sort things out before that. But like I say, I mean, Andy... Actually, both of you, AD and Andy, you were both there at the Chelsea game. I mean, is there anything that you can think of that springs to mind that says, no, we've still got to do something else before fans are let back in?
Not to my mind. It all worked very well. I mean, it was very simply organised. They'd set the attendance level, you know, very, very low. So all the procedures were going to work, but I think you could replicate that over, you know, three or maybe even all four of the stands, and you could really spread everybody out to have, you know, what, 7,500 in there or something of that nature, and it not be too bad.
Yeah, but Andy, I mean, you've also been doing a bit of a tour of Sussex, going around a lot of the non-league grounds recently, and obviously there has been a lot of social distancing aspects to that, and it's working there, isn't it?
Yeah, I'd say so. I mean, it's quite easy to spread yourself out around a non-league pitch. I'll be going to Whitehall this afternoon, and it's been fine. I mean, it's daft that National League teams can't have fans, but again, we don't really want to go down too many rabbit holes with this, but. Yeah. I just don't see why we can't have fans, a small number of fans at grounds.
Okay. I mean, it's a story that's going to rumble on and on and on. So, let's have a look at the game itself then. There was quite a bit of incident in it. I mean, it was almost worth staying up to watch Match of the Day for. Almost.
I think the thing that really started us off was seeing the team news, and it seemed to be we had about 26 defenders playing.
Yeah, but one of the team news was, Stephen Elzatti arrived late back from Colombia, so he was rested. Ben White was pushed forward into the midfield in replacement for him. It was a decent enough team, and again, I mean this game is I mean we might as well just repeat the last season's worth of shows. It's just the same.
Aren't you pleased we're playing really good football, though? I mean, it is going to come, but aren't you pleased that we're playing football of such high quality that we can batter everyone that way? I mean, let's, you know, step by step by step. I mean, I don't know how you two were, I mean, Andy, but you two watching the game, surely there was an element of you purring over some of the football that we were playing.
Yes, in particular, the way that we were really doing some beautiful through-the-middle push passes, like over quite considerable distances, you know, a good 20, 30 yards, the transition phase, as it is commonly known now, the Albion was absolutely superb from like the final third of our half and then moving up to the final third of their half. We're really moving the ball very quickly. I mean, obviously, maybe AD is embedded by the fact that Palace were putting everybody behind the ball, so that we weren't being pressed a great deal, certainly for, you know, the players who were in our half. But we were really moving the ball around superbly, and it was a real pleasure to see. And it's, you know, something we've often seen opponents do to us in the past, and it's like now we're doing it to other people. But of course, there is a but.
Isn't there always?
Once we have played these, made this wonderful transition to get to the 18-yard box, then suddenly it becomes a slightly less beautiful game as far as Albion are concerned, where we seem to have about 80% of possession on the 18-yard line as we decided what to do with the ball.
sometimes try and walk it in. I mean, you know, you, as you said, once Palace have got their goal, and we'll talk about their goal in a minute, once they got their goal and they did park the bus, there were times when, I mean, again, the criticism I've seen of people saying, oh, you know, why didn't we go through the middle of them? Because all we did was go out wide and we did nothing with it. You think, well, no, you're missing the point. To go through the middle is to go through the middle of traffic. And yet, a couple of times, we still managed to do that. Every aspect, apart from the result, which is, obviously is the most important thing, every aspect of it, Andy, we battered them.
Again, you know, for the second game that Selhurst did it in a row with the same result. I did actually remark to AD at one point, I said, we are trying to Arsenal this ball in. And why don't we just, you know, lamp it? You know, that was a common cry throughout the afternoon. But it was very, you know, it was nice. I think after the Everton game, it was nice to see us get back into a smooth footballing rhythm in response to, you know, a not probably our poorest performance of the season. That was very good. But it was just incredibly frustrating to not beat a team that we were clearly better than. And then we're a better team than them right now. And
we just can't prove it.
We are not making it tell. And, you know, that is something that Graham Potter has to work with the players to really sort of knuckle down with them and say, look, come on, guys, like, you've got to be doing better than this. This is all very well and good, but you've got to be more clinical. You cannot carry on doing this.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to talk a bit about the finishing first. I mean, a little bit later on, sorry. But I mean, we had a couple of chances before the Palace pen where Ibasuma smashed the ball into the side netting, obviously buoyed by his fabulous goal at Everton. I mean, it's nice to see Biss actually confident enough to take the shot on now, because, I mean, it's... Yes, some of them do fly high and wide. This one was one that wasn't high and wide, close. But you want to see your midfielder like kicking the football in the direction of the goal, basically.
Yeah, but in the direction of the goal, and it was off target. He, you know, he took the shot. When you're a professional footballer at times like that, and it's not as though he needed to snap at it. You know, that he had that opportunity, and there was plenty of the goal to aim at. I'd rather he make the goalkeeper make the save than having miss it. And like I said, with the stats that have come up about the shots on target and how many of them were, you know, sorry, the shots towards goal and how many were off target, they haven't learnt their lesson from last season. Like I say, the build-up play is so much better. The passing quality mostly is so much better. And we're you know, the sort of like the ranting that we had, you had, Andy, and others have had on this show about, you know, the quality of the finishing, which has let us down so often. Yeah, I appreciate Basuma had a good shot. So did Ben White. So did Adam Lallana. Mm. But none of them were on target. And
yeah, I mean, White was narrowly wide, but I mean, it was nice to see him get into that position and actually take the decision early, Andy.
I thought he could have done a bit better. I thought, again, that his build-up play to the actual shot was really good. And it was good to see him be enterprising in that attacking manner. But yeah, you know, but again, the finish was not really what you required. I didn't expect him to get it closer, but, you know, get it on target from there. And they're just going to have to work on it. I mean, practice. My constant bugbear. I mean, the first Basuma shot, I don't have a problem with that. It wasn't too bad. The ones I have a problem with are the ones that get ballooned over the bar, and it's just simple technique. You just got to get your body over the ball and keep it down. You know, for me, you know, if I was a manager, I would be finding players for that. It's like, it's unacceptable.
Maybe he does.
Okay. Well, let's get on to the the elephant that's in the room, which was the Palace penalty.
Would you have said that any slower? Are you Robert Peston?
I'm still frustrated about it.
My initial thing is when you see sort of this huge lump just falling over and there's little itty bitty Lamptey behind him, and you think, what is Lamptey that strong? I know he's quick, but is he really in a position to pull an entire cow over like that? It's when you see the referee blow the whistle and you think, okay, well, he must have seen something. You know where the press box is, AD. You know we're miles away from it. You see the replay then and you think, oh my God, this is a farce. then we have to get on to VAR. I mean, it is always in the opinion of the referee. Yes, I get that. That's the law of the game. But then this is where, and I think we do need to have actually have another conversation about it, is the application of VAR. It's there to spot deliberate and obvious errors, not necessarily to review the referee's decision. And I don't know about you, but I could not see what Tarek Lamptey did to pull Batshuayi over, in which case, where is the foul? Andrew, did you see a foul?
No, I did not. There was no foul. Batshuayi was already falling over. He fell into Lamptey. And then, yes, Lamptey's arm made contact with Batshuayi's falling, tumbling body. I mean, obviously, the referee is saying that Tarek Lamptey pulled Batshuayi to the floor.
There's zero evidence for that. Yeah.
That didn't happen. And you can look at it. It's quite easy to see that that is not the case. There was no foul. It should not have been given as a penalty. But given the quality of the on-pitch official and not our Kevin friend in the VAR.
Oh, was it him?
Yeah. It's just it's risible. It's utterly risible that these decisions are being made. You know, VAR is to stop howlers and injustice. It's not to rubber stamp rubbish decisions by the referee. We're a few days on now, and it turns out I'm still annoyed by this.
I mean, surely the yardstick, it would not be, if that was happening in the centre circle or anywhere else on the pitch, would not be given as a foul. It's not a penalty. The bloke just fell over.
Yeah.
Well, no, he didn't just fall over. He threw himself over.
Yeah.
There was nothing within the laws of physics, within the laws of sort of, you know, physical motion that said Batshuayi should do that. He has deliberately done that himself.
Well,
Lamptey didn't come over. Was it Webster in front of him? Webster didn't touch him. No. There was nothing that anyone did that allowed him to do that. He was
backpedaling and lost his balance.
Yeah.
Well, that's generous.
It was a penalty. Zaha scored again. Another penalty that Matt Ryan hasn't saved. I'm sure we get one soon. Hopefully, touch wood, because we're going to see more and more penalties with the current VAR interventions. But I mean, it was about a lot of misses. The main talking point was Neil Maupay's decision making. But before we get on to that, can we just talk about Adam Lallana's pass to set up that chance?
Well, it was a fairly obvious one and a fairly good one, and that's exactly what he's been brought in for. To be fair, it's a pass that Proper or Stevens could have done, but Lallana did, because that's the kind of pass that they know how to play. It's not a worldie in as much as, you know, that only someone as brilliant as Lallana could do. We've seen our players do that before. You're right, though. It's the receipt of the ball. It was on his right foot. I have absolutely no idea what was going through his mind. The only thing that possibly I could consider is that the ball got caught under his feet a little bit. Above and beyond that, I have absolutely... we're back to Baron Apsenor. I mean, and I do remember this. He turned around to me. He turned around to everyone else. He had the microphone on, couldn't say anything. But if you can imagine a guppy impression, you know, of a goldfish drowning kind of thing, you'll get as in to say... WTF, you know, why didn't you bury it? And it's that kind of decision making that is actually at the moment what we are grizzling about so much, you know, making us realise, is Maupay the answer? Then we'll talk about Danny Welbeck in a minute, and I think we have to talk about the other strikers in relation to Welbeck. But at the moment, we don't have anyone at the club who's actually just going to say to Maupay, stick the ball in the goal.
Let's talk about the goal then, because that's exactly what happened. I mean, and fair play to Maupay, he was very, very much involved in the goal. I mean, it was a poor, but I mean, it was the ball fell to McAllister, and who did take it first time with the shot, and it was just I was absolutely thrilled for him.
Well, it was just brilliant. Just, you know, I mean, it was a goal we thought was not going to come. We sort of resigned to it being one of those days at that point, and then he just comes on and just lamps it into the goal. It was absolutely brilliant, and delighted for McAllister. I mean, he's He's got a couple of goals in the Carabao Cup, but for him to get his first Premier League goal, open his account, it's really good. He's just one. He's one of those players. It's just like, I think he's a bit of a slow burner, but you just get the feeling that he could end up being something special. You know, he needed that goal. We needed that goal, and it was an exultant moment, because if we'd have lost that game, I'd have just been inconsolable.
But sorry, AD, there is one thing I would say, and you skipped over it a little bit, and I don't think it was necessarily clear on the television. I'm really not sure. Well, there's a couple of things. One, dear God, the amount of whinging that Palace got through, worse than you and me on the Albion Roar, AD. The amount of whinging they got through, I think it's really to cover up their inadequacies as professional footballers, because clearly they're not as good a team as the Albion. But secondly, it was the time between the penalty and probably about for another 20 minutes or so afterwards. I'm not sure that the Albion really lost their way, but I could see that there was a certain rage as an injustice, and almost along the lines of, oh no, not again. What on earth are we going to do about this? I thought that they played with a bit, not too much fire, but without the sort of like the appropriate concentration. It was almost too emotional the way they were playing, rather than totally professionally, which is what you expect them to be.
Well, yes, that was quite noticeable. We definitely lost our, I wouldn't say we lost our rag, but we did lose our concentration, and we were clearly upset by that decision.
No. We're still obsessed about it now, Al. There was obviously, but one of our players did see red, and it was a captain, Lewis Dunk. I can't
say boy.
Too many complaints about it.
None whatsoever.
No, it was a straight red.
He
will be missed.
I take issue with Danny Murphy's interpretation of it being malicious. I don't think he meant to hurt the player, but it was reckless, and it did endanger Gary Cahill, and you can't do that. You're off, son.
No, it wasn't malicious at all. I mean, you could see that because
he was going for the ball.
He was going for the ball, but he was flying in, and you cannot do that. I mean, because for a while we couldn't work out who had been sent off. We just saw the red card. Obviously, we don't have commentary in there, but you could see. Sorry,
it was Dunk.
Yeah, I know. Eventually, we got to see that. But you could see when the challenge went in, the entire penalty area went, ugh. You know, so, yeah, it's... I think, you know, Lewis Dunk doesn't do malicious. He's done careless before, but I don't think he's ever done malicious. Not apart from on Joey Barton after he stamped on Baron Kyle. I mean, he really took him out then. But apart from that, Dunk doesn't do vicious that much, does he?
It was just...
Yeah,
you could see what he's trying to do. The ball was there to be won. It was the last minute of the game. He was trying to force the ball over the line. You could see there was a crowd of bodies there, and he went in to try and get some power into the ball to force it over the bodies. But he missed the ball and got the man. So
yeah, but he also went in two-footed anyway. Even if he'd have got the ball, it would have been dangerous. So
yeah,
and again, still not the worst tackle of the weekend. But okay, you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. This show, as ever, is brought to you in association with the brilliant oldfootballshirts.com, and we have a great shirt of the week for you, which Andy's going to describe to us now. Good luck, Andy.
Thank you for making me look at this utter monstrosity of a shirt. Where to begin? It's basically two shirts sewn together, featuring a range of diamonds and pinstripes and sort of geometric groupings of stripes coming down. So we have at the very top, the top third is a blue background with pinstripes. That we then move down to the next part, which is a white background with one row of pinstripe sort of chevrons coming down. And then below that, we have two rows of blue diamonds on the white background. It just looks like some sort of cosmic Rorschach test.
You know what I think it looks like?
What do you think it looks like, Adrian?
If you sew together our current home shirt and the Chelsea Cause away shirt, that's this.
Well, I was actually thinking more in terms of our shirt and then with a beach towel wrapped round you.
Yes. Yeah, I think I'm going to go with owls. Yeah.
I think that's about right.
And also on the sleeves, it looks like Lideranza.
Lideranza, yeah. So,
And it's made by Umbro, we should point out.
Made by Umbro.
Okay, do you want to hazard a guess? Because we were booked
time. He's trying to shop the badge, isn't he?
Spain. I have no idea who it is.
I'm going to say Portugal.
Wrong continent, but close, Al. Here is your shirt of the week, chosen.
Brazil.
Because, well, I wanted to. This is the, this says Bill, by the way. This is the 2019 to 2023rd shirt of Brazilian side Avaí FC. They go by the nickname of Leão da Ilha, which translates to be the Lion of the Island. And they play in the second tier of Brazilian soccer called the Campeonato Cearense. Their home ground is the Rescada, which holds 18,000 supporters and is situated in the city of Florianópolis, which is in the island region of the Santa Catarina in southern Brazil. They were formed in 1923 and have played at all levels of Brazilian football. Their greatest rivals are Figueirense, and their home colours are blue and white stripes. I can't find any links to the UK, let alone Albion, so I guess I'll leave you all with the stat that their current manager, Rodrigo Santana, has managed 12 different teams since 2010. So there's every chance that he's been sacked since I wrote this. Thanks, Phil.
Did you say third shirt or 23rd shirt?
This is, yeah, it's the third shirt.
Do you want to put at least two shirts before that?
Well, of course, this shirt and over 110,000 others are available on unfootballshirts.com for your delectation. Please go on there, have a look. Just a quick note on the notice board. Now, obviously, the game on Monday night is on pay-per-view. This has gone down indifferently with a lot of our supporters, but in line with what a lot of other club supporters groups are doing, there is a pay-per-view boycott, which is basically what they're saying is rather than paying the £15 or £14.95 to watch the game, you can donate that to the Brighton Food Bank, which is obviously a worthy destination for your poundage. You can go to the www.brightonfoodbank.org.uk if you wish to do that, obviously. Or you can watch it on pay-per-view. I mean, it's your choice.
Or you can do both if you wish.
You can do both.
I don't like the idea of the idea of, you know, do one and not the other. I mean, if you wish to do so, then obviously it's entirely up to anyone how they spend their money. You know, they can do both. But having said that, donating to a Brighton Food Bank is always worthwhile, notwithstanding the tragedy of the fact that we have to have food banks at the moment. Sorry, Eddie, carry on.
Well, no, like I said, it's a big game for the Albion. It's a must-win game. Well, it's not a must-win. Well, is it a must-win game,
Eddie? Every game is a must-win game, Eddie. Otherwise, there's no point in turning up.
Absolutely. Well, it would be nice to have the choice.
Isn't it? Well, yeah.
But, yeah, but if you wish to do that, all the details are over on our Twitter page, if you wish to do that. But like I said, you've got various options. Okay, we've made a new signing, Andy Bass. We signed England international Danny Welbeck on a one-year deal. Is this what we'd be looking for?
I think it is, actually. I think it's fairly clear that the team regard Neil Maupay and Aaron Connolly as strikers one and two at the moment. And I don't think that we were really in the market for a new number one by splashing out tens of millions for a sort of bigger name. I think we wanted a supplemental player to fill out the forward ranks. And to be honest, Welbeck does more, you know, does that more than adequately. I think it's an absolute steal. Makes a lot of sense for him. It gives him a chance to be back in the Premier League. It's not going to set us back too much money, and we get a player that is proven at the top level. Premier League, his record for England is absolutely stunning. And the guy's a good finisher, and exactly the sort of player that we're looking for. Obviously, he comes with the caveat of fitness, But you know, we don't need him to start every game.
Yeah, Al, I mean, this is a really high caliber signing, really, in the history of Brighton and Albion. I mean, this is. I mean, does it shadow that of signing Bobby Smith?
The thing about Danny Welbeck is that, yes, we know we've inherited a sick note, but we've also inherited someone who I think most importantly would actually fit into the Graham Potter style. It's, in the same way as that, like, you could probably make a case for the similarity in style between Glenn Murray and Danny Welbeck, in as much as they're big, they're strong, yes, they can finish. But I think that Glenn Murray's approach play is always a little bit Bambi on ice. And I think that Danny Welbeck is actually more of a Potter type player. Now, when you see the ball going into Mopay, you see it going into Trossard, you see it going into Connolly. Yes, they're always looking to do something, but they're also always looking to bring a player in. And I think that Danny Welbeck has that, just that little extra spark of having been at Manchester United, having been at Arsenal, having been in the England setup, of having that, just that little, for me, I hope and I think he will be something like what I would call Glenn Murray plus, which is that he can bring players into the game, but he can do it, you know, intelligently and clinically, not cynically, but clinically. And will also show Mopay and Connolly and the others the odd trick or two that, you know, they might have picked up under, you know, various inastute managers.
Andy, I was saying that the season is playing second fiddle to Morpé. I don't see that at all. I mean, obviously, he's come not being completely fit at the moment. But, I mean, this is a guy who's up until only like 2 years ago. I mean, obviously, yes, he's made a blast and had injury problems. But he was one of England's first-choice strikers. You know, this guy has got ambitions to get back into the England setup. And the only way he's going to do that is by being good for Brighton at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, he's a quality footballer, and it is a signing we should all be excited about. I mean, I am, and I can see him having a fairly immediate impact once he gets on. I wonder whether, due to fitness concerns, whether he'll start too many games in the near future. But you could see him coming on late on in games and just tucking away these chances that we are creating. The thing is that there's a point to someone like Danny Welbeck being in this Albion side now, because we do create chances, and I think we're going to be, you know, we can help him thrive. It's very exciting. It gives Potter a lot of options. Now we're not stuck with Mopay and Connolly. We've got Welbeck in our back pocket. We've got Zakiri. He's just like, there's the wild card. We have no idea what he's going to be like, but we now have options. We're not stuck in a narrow, you know, in a cul-de-sac when it comes to forward options.
I should point out, Andy, at this point as well, I mean, the squad numbers have been announced this week, most of which we've known because we've played loads of games since. But the interesting inclusion within that is, particularly when you see Arsenal's ones and they've omitted Mesut Ozil completely from theirs, we've included Florin Andoni in our initial 25.
Yes, well, I think it's been fairly obvious from what the club have been saying in recent months is that they fully expect him to come back in January.
What's his number, 666?
I mean, 21 now.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we've been fairly sparse in our forward choices, and he is on our books. He's our player. He has qualities that would certainly be appreciated by the team. And yeah, absolutely. You know, get him back in. Beggars can't be choosers.
I think that there is one thing I would say about the Danny Welbeck sign, which does scream more than anything. And it's not the fact that he is still only 29. It's the fact we've only offered him 1 year. A 29-year-old should be in the peak of his career. And we've offered him 1 year. That says, I think, an awful lot about the Albion's fairly cautious approach to it. Don't get me wrong, if he does well, then he'll get extra years. So this is the 1 year screams the fact that they are well aware that, gentlemen, they may not be able to rebuild him.
Yeah. Well, I would like to point out the fact that also in that squad list is number 19, Jose Escuero. Now, obviously, he's now fit again. He's been playing for the sort of 23s in his quest to get match fitness. So clearly the physios are bored. That's why we signed Danny Welbeck, to keep the physios employed. No, it's not. I really hope that he hits the ground running for us. And I'm really excited by this signing. I can't wait to see him
on the pitch.
And from what I spoke to a couple of Watford fans this week, and they're both saying that actually, yes, he did miss a lot of the season last season through injury, but when he did come back, he was absolutely brilliant for him, and he scored one of the goals of the season towards the end of last season. So if he can get fit and firing for us, and like Andy said, I mean, we leave so many points in the pitch and we create so many chances. It's someone with the nous and the know-how to take them instinctively. It can only be good for us.
This is a squad, AD, which is well capable of improving on last year's 15th place. It is capable of doing so. I see improvements just about everywhere, and that includes the new signings. This is a squad that's easily capable of actually bettering the 15th place that we got last year, I think. One of the things about doing the Albion Raw is that we get to talk to other fans' podcasts. And one I'm a semi-regular on is the Anfield Wrap, listened to by a lot more people than the Albion Raw, believe me. But I'm delighted to say we've got Neil Atkinson from the Anfield Wrap who's with us. Neil, I was about to say welcome back, but it's actually you're on our show. So welcome back.
Welcome back indeed. I think we've been on a few years back and very much enjoyed our trip down to Brighton. And I'll be honest with you, Alan, I wish I could go to Brighton right now. I wish we could all move all over the place. It'd be great to turn up in person.
Well, one, it's tier one, and two, it's sunny, so it's not so bad. Now, we've been talking about all sorts of things just before we got to you, and we talk about stuff when I go onto the Anfield Wrap. There is the big thing which is enveloping a lot of top football in the country at the moment, and that is that we've got Project Big Picture has sort of like reared its ugly head, and it came and then sort of went back down again. We've had the pay-per-view, which is, the mess that we've got between the broadcasters and the Premier League, and we've got the European Super League, which has been talked about for so many years as the next big thing after the Premier League. But the issue I want to talk to you about, Neil, is the fact that the Liverpool Football Club, rightly or wrongly, have been put front and centre of these stories. And as an honest broker for Liverpool Football Club, or certainly for their fans, I'm just interested as to what the feeling is up on Merseyside about how Liverpool are being seen as kind of, priors of the game at the moment.
I think that Liverpool fans are hugely disparate on the issue. That's also the case within the Anfield Wrap. I think that each of these three things that you actually just mentioned, I think, are interconnected. My responses to them are quite markedly different. So I think it's to sort of move through them. My start point on this is, I've got no interest as a match-going Liverpool supporter in a European Super League. I wouldn't enjoy particularly a European Super League, and I say this as someone who absolutely loves European football. And I think that in general, I think that opinion is the case for a lot of match-going Liverpool supporters. I think that when you've got a worldwide supporter base, you will end up with one or two people who may not feel entirely like that. So we've got to acknowledge that that's the case, and that part of why this appeals is there is a little bit of a worldwide fan base who wonders exactly what is the purpose of playing Burnley to an extent, and it would be disingenuous for me to pretend that those people don't exist and Liverpool sits as a united front. I think in terms of the pay-per-view, there has been quite the backlash from Liverpool support in general in the United Kingdom. I think for me, why the pay-per-view is interesting is to move on to the Project Big Picture sort of conversation. In that, one of the reasons why the pay-per-view, which I'm strongly against, I think that those matches should be getting televised for free at this stage, but one of the reasons why I think they should be getting televised for free is that it's been crystal clear that the Premier League can televise them for free because of the decisions that were made from when football comes back after lockdown, going right the way back to June, July. One of the bigger issues around all of that was the Premier League itself, I believe and would argue, has shown itself really poor in terms of its decision-making. And in terms of its capacity to plan medium term in a crisis. And I think that this begins to hit at one or two of the issues where you can discuss Project Big Picture philosophically. I don't want there to be a Manchester United and Liverpool carve-up of the Premier League. Honestly, if you gave me a blank piece of paper, I'd say let's put all the big television money into a pot and split it 92 ways. and I'd be perfectly happy with that. Like, that is my sort of, that's almost my idyllic position in a sense. I wouldn't have a problem if that was the decision. But I think there has been a long-term issue, and I'm going 10, 12, 15 years of football governance in this country, football planning in this country, which I think needs to be addressed. And I actually think that the Premier League, or the clubs in the Premier League, the EFL, the FA, I'll go so far as to say, you know, even bodies like the Football Supporters Association, we should all be a bit embarrassed it's actually taken American billionaires to say we could do with changing this, because it's needed to change for an awful long time. And yes, they've played real politic with it and they've tried to put something together to their advantage, which, by the way, they hadn't finished before it was leaked. But we should have all been doing that. It's been in two Tory successful manifestos to have a fan-led review of the Premier League and of football in this country, and neither of them have been enacted yet. And I think in general, the game is well overdue for a change in its vision and its outlook. And that's why I'm not as anti the notion of Project Big Picture, in that my issue with Project Big Picture is it wasn't big picture enough. It was small picture. And it was too self-interested a picture as well from a Liverpool and Manchester United point of view. We actually need a proper Project Big Picture. And no one appears to be able to stick the hand up. And the desire to just to dismiss what Liverpool and Manchester United put on the table and not at least try to use it, maybe even not as a starting point, but as a jumping off point where they've indicated there's a desire to give some revenue away, I think is hugely problematic. And we're just going to kick this down the road. And the Neville and Bernstein thing was full of nice notions, but it had no specificity in either. And I don't think this is very complex. I think there's a set of wants and needs for a number of different clubs. And I think there's loads of middle ground that can be found, but there isn't the will to find it.
So when you mention about the supposedly Liverpool-Manchester United, and like I say, it was an unfinished document by the time it got leaked. I think it was on version 18, which is one that eventually made it out into the public. Do you believe that, you know, the notion of leaking it was to say, hang on, this is, you know, a terrifying way for football to be going, and someone sort of said, look, you know, be warned, this is bumping down the pipeline, and we need to have this, you know, the brakes applied immediately. So assuming that was the case, and then we have to make that on that assumption that whoever it was that leaked it to the paper was doing it with, you'd like to think, a certain level of benevolent, but maybe certain self-benevolence, is that it was actually a starting point from which we could have a debate or a genuine power grab.
Well, I think that the leak happens because I think there's a lot of people for whom the status quo in the Premier League suits currently. And that includes quite literally the Premier League itself. But there's a lot of people for whom, a lot of clubs for whom the status quo suits them absolutely down to the ground. And this is one of the issues, in that at no point, I think there's lots of ways in which, if you were to be imaginative and, as I say, be genuinely big picture, you can grow the Premier League, you can grow revenues within the Premier League, you can find a way to meet the wants and needs of a number of different Premier League clubs. But I think all the Premier League clubs, and we saw it around the restart of football, you even saw it around the five subs thing, which I know that Brighton were the only other club that voted for outside of the big six. I think there is an issue around everybody just has an attitude when they are in the Premier League, if they aren't in the big six. And I don't like the phrase the big six for a variety of reasons, but an attitude pervades of what we have, we hold at all times. So I found all the discourse around Project Restart thoroughly depressing, because what it turned into was, it seemed like there was a number of clubs who seemed quite happy to risk football clubs, including some in the Premier League, but also up and down the pyramid, going out of business if it meant we didn't have to start playing football again and they wouldn't have to risk relegation. And I think what we've got to be careful here not to do is to genuinely cast the other 14 Premier League clubs with halos above them as though they are acting within the interests of the game up against the mean, nasty Liverpool and Manchester United. I'm not standing for that for a second. I think you've seen unbelievable levels of self-interest from almost every Premier League club and from the Premier League as a whole over the last 10 years. So when clubs have been in the Premier League, they show astonishing levels of self-interest. The Premier League itself shows astonishing levels of self-interest. In general, for me, this problem is best thought of as a problem with the Championship. And I think if you begin to think about how to solve the Championship is a huge spectre. It should not be. West Ham United were prepared, seemingly to shut the season down with all the knock-on effects and ramifications that would have, which would be legal issues that we'd still be dealing with, not just now, but in 5 to 10 years' time, so as they weren't going to get relegated to the Championship. And clubs in the Championship gamble everything, gamble fortunes on becoming Premier League clubs. So the Championship is, within English football, this morass, this pit. You move from League One to the Championship and the average costs of everything from CEOs down to scouts goes up tenfold. So the Championship's a remarkably expensive division to be in if you're a League One club. It's a remarkably punishing division to be in if you're a Premier League club. It's exacerbated by parachute payments. And for me, the way I'd be offering stability to the 14 other Premier League clubs who aren't in the Big Six, of whom I think this only probably applies to sort of 8 or 9, would be to extend and create a Premier League 2 scenario so that we get rid of what's been basically killing the way football operates. It should not feel like a death blow to get relegated. And the reason why is because this season, 3 clubs will get relegated. So why are we putting our, why has the Premier League created a situation where we're putting 3 clubs through absolute hell every single season and making them feel as though it is the end of everything? How have we created this? And this goes on for years. And I think that any big picture needs to address that.
With that in mind, Neil, I mean, what sounds like you're doing is you're not so much sort of removing the problem from the Premier League, you're extending the problem from one division to two, because then what you'll have is, and unless there's a further caveat to what you're saying here, is that then you'll have this enormous gap, and it's a big enough gap, as you've just mentioned, between League One and the Championship. So I guess that probably what you're suggesting is that the extension of a Premier League 2 and whatever that would entail, would have to be done with the redistribution of wealth, you know, in a much more egalitarian way.
Absolutely. What my argument would be, if we follow it all through, I think you can make a pretty strong argument that somewhere in their bones, between 28 and 38 clubs in English football feel like Premier League clubs. Whether rightly or wrongly, whether you or I agree, Nottingham Forest feel like they should be a Premier League club. Mm-hmm. So I think if you had a situation where you had, let's say, 32 or 34 teams across 2 divisions, then firstly, I think that the clubs that I genuinely view as community asset clubs, they're somewhere in number in the English football pyramid between sort of 45 and 55. Should they get to have ambitions? Absolutely, and those can be addressed. But what I think you can do is it's much easier for the EFL to take care and ensure that a fewer number of clubs are being run well and run properly. And then within that, for instance, what you don't do is you don't allow parachute payments. So if you have 32, and I would do it with 32, if you have 32, you'd have the Premier League 1 and a Premier League 2. And you just, by the way, you don't have a massive difference between finishing 16th, i.e. bottom of one division, and finishing 17th, the top of the other. It just goes the steps as they currently go. Currently, anyway, with parachute payments, we pay money, theoretically, in the Premier League to 29 clubs a season anyway, because the parachute payments last for 3 years, and it could be across 3 clubs. So this wouldn't be a massive change, but what it would offer would be a number of clubs greater security. And then what we could do on top of that then is you then put in all the rules and legislation you need around enforced wage cuts if you move between divisions, but not just cuts, but also wage increases if you get promoted from League One. And I think if we do that, what we end up with is a pyramid that just functions far better, where I think that ultimately you can then move on and be much more ambitious with the EFL in terms of what you want those clubs to actually be. A really good example is that clubs should be able to diversify a little bit. There is no reason, for instance, why a football club in an area couldn't run that area's FA, as an example, and they could bid for that and they could be able to receive the money for that. Because when we get down to League One and League Two, in terms of how these clubs function, we're looking at short, small amounts of money. But then on top of that, I couldn't agree more. If it was me and you were giving me a blank piece of paper, but I wasn't allowed to do the 92 thing, then I think we've got in writing a commitment there that, you know, if you were to take in a few more Premier League clubs, let's say my number's 12, you can then look at saying, well, let's give 20% of Premier League TV money down the EFL pyramid. So those clubs are in a stronger position. We already know that there's a willingness to give some of that away. I think within that, there's other ways then you could incentivize things around the Premier League and allow their revenues to grow. But you could always say, for instance, I think I'd always love to see, Alan, is genuinely, we have a myth in English football that aside doing well in Europe is good for the country. That isn't necessarily
where that comes from. I've no idea. Yeah. Because that club is never representing the country. It represents itself.
But we can make that a positive, and that what we could say is, and my ironic figure, because it's currently the amount the Premier League gives to the AFL, we could, for instance, say that any club that competes in European football has to give 4% of its prize money, and its television money, to the AFL. But within that, then, we then accept that when the Champions League grows, with Liverpool and Manchester United in it, and that goes up, then they are giving some of that money over, and we've created the opportunity by increasing the reducing the number of games in the Premier League they have to play. There's loads of things that we can do here, and then we can have a Premier League tournament that happens every sort of 4 years or so, anywhere in the world, as it would be. Let's be honest about that, and I wouldn't have a problem with that. That increases revenues, but those revenues can be shared with the AFL as well. There's loads of ways in which all of this can work, but it needs a big picture outlook, and what it needs is for people not to panic as soon as somebody says absolutely anything and presume it's the end of days.
So what I've got coming from you here is that obviously there's a, if you look at a graph as to how much the Premier League gets, the clubs get, and how much the Championship gets, and then League One, what you're effectively saying is you're kind of flattening the curve a little.
Significantly, you know, yeah.
Smoothing the curve a lot. So that's okay. That's sort of Neil's sort of back of fag packet big picture. Actually, that's probably a little bit unfair. I think it's clear he spent a bit of time thinking about that. Tell us what you think about what Neil's just said there, either on Twitter or on our Facebook page. Just give us an idea what a genuine Liverpool fan is thinking of the big picture. You know, he said about splitting the TV revenues 92 ways, about having a Premier League too, which, you know, whether the money is split more evenly. Let us know what you think. But the sort of thing that everyone else is slightly panicking about, and I think is people are a little more sort of belligerent about rather than sort of panicking about, is the European Super League. And you said at the top of this, you're not so fussed on it. Oh. What's your concern about it?
My concern about it is that I genuinely, and I hope it's just come through from what I've said there, I absolutely love English League football. I love going to Brighton. I love going to Burnley. I love those away occasions. I think in general, though, my biggest issue is too much of a good thing. I love European football. You know, we just played Ajax last night and I was absolutely devastated that, you know, we couldn't go over to Amsterdam. In normal circumstances, we probably would have took about 30,000 to Amsterdam, to be quite honest with you. It would have been outrageous. But I think, you know, ultimately European football works at its best when it's the adornment to a season. And I think that is ultimately what I think you lose if you go down the route of any form of a Super League. I'm absolutely fine to be... Yeah, but the closed shop, but also it's not even so much the closed shop, it's literally having a nice time. You know, I love doing a European away, and I'm so... And by the way, as part of my other big picture plan, I think that the winner of the EFL Trophy should get to go into the European Conference, because what I think matters is that more sides should get to experience European football, because it's such a brilliant thing to do with your football club and be part of that. And we're so lucky to get to do it as often as we do it from a Liverpool point of view, because it genuinely is incredible, and to have that in your life is a good thing. But you would just be overwhelmed by it. Where are we this week? We're away at Paris. We were away at Paris last season. Yeah, we do this every single year. Now, are you going to go to Paris? I can't be bothered going to Paris. It's an awful long way and it's a big palaver. We're watching the same players over and over again. I loved watching in the ground Neymar and especially Mbappe when Paris Saint-Germain came to Anfield a couple of seasons ago. It was great. But ultimately, part of the reason why it was great was that it doesn't happen very often. And that's all right. And I actually think that, you know, we would be overwhelmed by it from just simply being a supporter point of view. And then the idea that you'd do something like that and it'd do irreparable damage to the English football pyramid is, to me, I think, really grim. And then within that, the idea of locking it so that you don't have promotion and relegation. Again, if you give me a blank piece of paper, I can create in my head regional leagues that cross borders. You know, I'm sure Celtic and Rangers would love it, that we could rebuild football from scratch and do so with a real sense of egalitarianism. But that won't be present within this. And it's hard enough. There'll be people who've listened to what I've just said about Project Big Picture who'll be livid with me. And I accept that. It's hard enough to find common ground across supporter bases in this country. The idea of trying to do it, you know, the English and Germans have a completely different outlook to away football matches than they have in Spain and Italy. Completely different. How do we find common ground and be able to work with one another and get the best out of the game with one another? And I'm someone who completely accepts that football is now, for all of us, including match-going supporters, it is a majority, It is a majority television-based exercise. Whether we like it or not, that is actually currently the case philosophically. Not just because of the current COVID situation, but other than, say, 3,000 Liverpool supporters, it's almost impossible to go to every match. So you watch at least half of your team's matches on television anyway, whoever you are. Then you watch Match of the Day, then you watch your rivals. We all watch more television than we do see football in the flesh on the whole. Mm. But that doesn't mean it's necessarily that's what you want it to solely become in a continent-wide sense. And you also close the continent off. How many of these Portuguese sides that I love getting in Europe are we going to get? We played Ajax last night. Would they be in the European Super League? They should be. And what it opens up is a can of worms. And this is why I think it's never happened. I think it is almost literally too hard to do. And I think that it's best. I think people are angry about it, but ignore it.
It closes you off from the rest of Europe as well.
Yeah, of course it does. It closes, like we play Maribor a couple of seasons back.
Closes you off from the rest of Europe.
Yeah, of course it does. You know, we played Maribor a couple of seasons back, and everyone who went out had a fabulous time. I remember going to Levski Sofia, where Ludogorets were then playing their games in Sofia at that point. I think it was Levski's ground. And it was great to get to go to Sofia. Like, I literally would not otherwise have gone to Bulgaria in my life, and I got to go and do that. I don't want to be closed off from this sort of stuff. But also in general, I think it's... The issue with it is, and the reason why it'll be pushed, is because Real Madrid and Barcelona are mostly terrified. They've got themselves into a number of different pickles. Juventus aren't too dissimilar, and everyone's a bit scared of the Premier League. And it's worth remembering that as part of this, that everyone's a bit scared of that. But again, though, there will be a direction of travel. There will be some money dangled at some stage for there to be... And I haven't got a problem with the thing I'm about to say. And again, a lot of people... I loved it when we won the Club World Cup in Qatar. I loved it. I love that we got to be world champions, never been world champions. Like, if you're a Liverpool supporter, your club's been everything, but we'd never been that. And that was brilliant. Mm. I haven't got a problem with the idea of there being 1 year in four a Club World Cup. I don't think it's outrageous. People want to act as though, my God, you're ripping at the fabric. I don't think that's outrageous. And I think that will happen at some point. But what I would hate is if you ended up having that and the European Super League, and what I'd really question, literally what the purpose of going to the games would be if those things weren't the treats, the rewards that you get for being excellent when you play Burnley, for being excellent when you play Sunderland, for being excellent when you go to these places and get results. Should be the reward.
It takes away the concept of reward for playing in England anyway, which would then would say the Premier League would end up saying, well, if you're going to play in, and this is a political thing from the Premier League, is that, well, if you're going to play in that, then you're going to have to resign from the Premier League, and that's not a can of worms entirely.
But it'd be awful.
Moving on from that, I mean, if only Brighton and Hove Albion had this problem. I mean, you know, the best we've ever had is when the Hull City fans once sang to us, you're so far south, you're practically French.
But on that, though, I'll come back to you on that. So this is why, I'll give you a really good example, and this is why the way in which the big picture stuff's being framed. The idea that we played a 32-team Premier League tournament abroad once every 4 or 5 years should make you think that'd be great. I could go and watch, you should be thinking to myself, Brighton play in insert name of place here. And instead, the way we've got locked into with our thinking around football is to think, my God, that would be awful. It would all be about money. It would all be about overseas fans. Overseas fans, firstly, aren't a bad thing. I've gone and been with them. I've gone on Liverpool's pre-season tours. And trust me, they know they're not watching competitive football and they wish they were. But within that, I would love for the idea that Brighton and Hove Albion supporters get to watch at some point their team play in Miami. Why not? Why can't that be part of our football journey that everybody gets the opportunity every now and again to watch their team play abroad? And the reason why not is we recoil from it. And the reason why we recoil from it is we're so used to all changing football to be both presented and the reality of it to be financially driven first and foremost. There is a variant on big picture which allows clubs to grow in terms of the amount of revenue, allows them to grow in terms of overseas support, but which allows match-going supporters to experience something that's really quite different that at the moment they don't get to do. But what happens is no one articulates it that way, because the people who put these ideas forward are primarily money men in the first place, and then the thing that we then all do is go, oh my God, the money men are getting involved again, rather than see it as, well, wouldn't it be brilliant, genuinely brilliant, for Nottingham Forest to be playing in Hong Kong, talking about the fact that they've won two European Cups, and talking about Brian Clough, and talking about their history, and getting a Hong Kong supporters club together, and getting people over there to think, my God, Nottingham Forest, I'm backing them in Premier League 2 this season. All of this sounds like it's absolutely idyllic stuff, but it sort of isn't. It can happen. But what needs to happen around that is a real shift in mindset.
Okay, again, let us know what you think on that on Twitter and on Facebook. Now, let's return to well, the past 18 months, real bête noire, and something that is obviously a hot topic for Brighton and Liverpool, as we mentioned on the show already, is VAR. Now, I think it's probably just easier for me to say, Neil, go.
The problem with VAR now is, and it feeds into the previous conversation to a sense, is that everybody feels as though everything that ever changes in football is inherently bad. And I've got a massive problem with that because we don't progress without change. The flip side of that is VAR has now got this massive issue where the way in which it's functioning and being employed is inherently bad. So it's understandable that people logically conclude, my God, this is not or hasn't been a good change. The biggest issue that VAR has philosophically, before we get into the specifics, but we can use Liverpool and Palace last weekend as good examples, is that it's all right to delay everything if the decisions that are made at the end feel as though they are both are right and feel as though they are right. If both of those things is the case, then we all swallow VAR and we say, well, say what you want. It's at least hitting its level on this. The Palace one in the end, I actually think becomes, well, no, I think that the Jordan Pickford one becomes as significant. But the Palace one, where when you and I spoke about this early in the week and I said it was a soft penalty, you said, no, Neil, it just wasn't a penalty. And I watched it back again and you were absolutely right to take that view. So where this all becomes difficult is that they've decided that they do not care about clear and obvious in the context of offsides. But clear and obvious becomes unbelievably subjective in the context of other things that happen on the pitch. And that disconnect is now so great, it leads to what we saw last weekend, where the last-minute Sadio Mane played ball for Jordan Henderson is deemed to be illegal when it could just be the flap of his shirt that could be offside, on the one hand. On the other hand, when the penalty that Crystal Palace that Crystal Palace benefit from against Brighton, when that penalty is given and then not ruled out for being clear and obvious, or when Jordan Pickford absolutely loses complete control of himself. I'm not saying that I think it is in part a personality issue with Pickford. I think he is irresponsible. And I think he is a deeply immature footballer. I don't think he's malevolent. I don't think he's going in to hurt Van Dijk, but he's a deeply irresponsible footballer in a lot of what he does. And he's not in control of himself in that moment. And he should be punished for it, not retrospectively. I almost don't care about retrospectively. He should be punished at that moment on the field to play with a red card. And those two things are so glaringly clear and obvious that therefore when the ridiculously marginal offside ends up being given against you, you're almost like, I cannot believe this. And this is what does for everyone, I think, in that...
This is where emotion takes over, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, but it's also where you stop feeling like it's logical. They were doing this thing on BT where they kept saying, and obviously the goal's not being given, and I kept saying, well, it's not obvious. Let it be obvious. I wanted to see an angle where I was able to go, and with the lines drawn, or even without the lines drawn, I wanted to be able to go, oh, yes, Sadio was off. He was a bit slow coming back because he doesn't think Thiago will play the pass. It's one of them. You didn't get that. And I think that this is the problem. The problem becomes, and why people are feeling almost a physical, like almost feeling it within themselves, no matter how rational people are trying to remain being, is you don't get to decide that one thing can be infinitesimal and the other thing has to be clear and obvious. It's either all going to be right or we cop for the fact that it's occasionally going to be wrong. And if the whole point
of VAR was always supposed to be, it was to overlook to look at it as being a clear and obvious error. And it's not. It's clearly being used to review a situation. And it's not there to review it. It's to actually see if it's clear and obvious. Now, the thing is, if as I've said on the show already, if Batshuayi that hadn't been given a penalty, there's no way that the fourth official, the VAR would have said, you might want to have a look at that. I mean, I wouldn't be able to believe that if that was the case. It would be just play on. So is it almost a case of there's a buddy-buddy relationship going on with the referees to say that they're not going to undermine each other?
So the next part of this is the human element, and that's a huge problem, the human element's employment here. Supposedly, for the Pickford one of the things that came out, but there's not enough clarity around it, was that he didn't think to review. He was too busy worrying about whether or not Van Dijk was offside and therefore a penalty would be given. He didn't think to review the incident and work out whether or not a red card should be given. And if that's the case, then that's just rank bad refereeing. One of the issues, though, is the thing about rank bad refereeing is that the players on the pitch, at the very least in the current climate, or us in the stands in the ideal world, can then take the matter up in our own way with the official. In this instance, we don't even get that. You don't even get that moment. You don't get Jordan Henderson being able to confront David Coote and say, lad, you need to think about this again. You've just absolutely dropped one there. That doesn't happen. And that again causes another problem. It becomes this unseen thing. And I think in general, the shrouding of it isn't good. I think there's just loads of little bits of it where there's part of it to me that feels as though, and this is, and it isn't just a Liverpool thing, like we benefited from it at times last season, although there was times it went against us last season. It isn't just a Liverpool thing. And why this is a little bit annoying is that a lot of this ends up being a Liverpool thing because it was a massive game, Merseyside derby on the telly, et cetera, et cetera. But it needs, you almost feel now like if they'd have designed a way to undermine it all, my God, they're enacting it brilliantly. You know what I mean? If this was the grand plan, and it isn't the grand plan, I'm not that guy. I'm not saying it is the grand plan. It's just every little bit of it. There will be another one this weekend. There will be another one in another one of the, Manchester United are playing Chelsea this weekend at 5:30 on Saturday. And there will be a stinker written all over it in there somewhere, not least with United's record with penalties. There was Brighton with the penalty being, awarded after the final whistle had gone.
Don't go there.
Exactly. All of these things. Football is about feelings, and we want to rationalise it as much as we can at times, and I'm fine with that process, but it's about feelings. And when things just cannot feel or sit right, that's one of the areas where, in any walk of life, where there always ends up being a problem. It's one of the reasons why, for instance, when you want to discuss redistributive politics, people will always say you're better off talking about fairness than you are using the word redistributive, which I just struggle to say. People understand the notion of fairness.
Don't worry, I've got it.
People understand the notion of fairness, and I think within that, that's one of the problems here at the moment within sort of this little journey has been there's just lots of things that are happening that in the moment don't look or feel fair, and then they aren't adequately explained, and it doesn't feel like there's any major change. And then on top of that, there's this IFAB thing that's ongoing where the rules are being mostly tweaked all the time. That makes it harder again because what constituted handball last season doesn't constitute handball this season. We all haven't got time to sit round and do PowerPoints. We are at times let down a little bit by our punditry class for whom actually, they are paid. It wouldn't kill them to be on top of the detail. There I could that. Sort of do without co-commentators not understanding the rules.
That as well, we've been down this road before. I mean, it doesn't help when you got sort of like the consideration of there's no way that Pickford could have been sent off because Van Dijk was offside before him. No, that's not how the laws of the game work. I'm just going to throw this one just before we go. I just want to throw this one at you. Do you believe there's any mileage that could be gained in having recently retired referees as VAR people? Given the fact that they seem to have had but just by the nature of the fact they're retired, they've got a bit more experience of refereeing matches.
I think there's that, but also I think the thing is, they don't have to see each other. They don't have to be fourth officials for one another. They don't have to have the conversation afterwards. Yeah, they're not pals. And I think that there is an element of that, and they don't have those sorts of inbuilt work relationships. That could be a power-based relationship. There was a thing that was said after last season when we didn't have one ruled out against us when Origi was fouled in the build-up and Man United went and scored, and I was convinced it was going to get ruled out. I was in the ground at Old Trafford. And afterwards, one of the things that was said was, it takes a lot to overrule Martin Atkinson. And I was like, well, you can't have that. You can't have this.
It's about the laws of the game.
Exactly. You can't suddenly say, the personality of Martin Atkinson will win through in this one. And that was sort of said as though it was a bit of a matey point again through commentary. Yeah. It takes a lot to overrule Martin Atkinson, does it? Yeah. There is this, I think that removing that would help. But there's another phase of this, which is that I do wonder ever so slightly as if it could just simply be a different job. Mm. There's the idea that it might be that it will be better done not being done by trained referees, that it might just simply have a slightly different skill set, not least because you need someone who can manipulate and work with the images very, very quickly, who knows what it is specifically, what it is that they're looking for, and who can then possibly direct the on-field official to act a little bit differently. And my next point on this as well would be that if they're doing what they're doing with offsides and they can't get a computer to do it, then they shouldn't be doing it.
Neil Atkinson of the Anfield Wrap. Always a pleasure, never a chore.
Thank you.
Thanks very much indeed for coming on to the Albion Raw.
Thanks to Neil for joining us on the Albion Raw this week. And thank you to Andy Bass for joining us once more, and to Alan Wares. I've been Andy Packer, and this has been the Albion Raw on Radio Reverb.
If I fell in love with you, would you promise to be true and help me understand, 'cause I've been in love before, and I found that love was more than just holding hands. If I give my heart to you. I must be sure from the very start that you would love me more than her. If I trust in you, oh please, don't run and hide. If I love you too, oh please, don't hurt my pride like her, 'cause I couldn't stand the pain, and I would be sad if our new love was in vain. So I hope you see that I would love to love you, and that she will cry when she learns we are two, 'cause I couldn't stand the pain, and I would be sad if our new love was in vain. So I hope you see that I would love to love you, and that she will cry when she learns we are two, if I fell in love.